Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
And what's up today, Chief?
Well, we have two great people to talk to.
We do.
It'll be a good show. Two folks that we've talked to in the past, so yeah. We know from experience. We have Tony Avent, who's the owner of Plant Delights Nursery in North Carolina, and he's going to talk to us about the arum, which is a plant that you totally can enjoy right now in the garden, among others. I'm certainly engage him on some of the other delightful plants that we can see out this time of the year, but arum's the topic of the day.
Yeah, arum's kind of backwards, which I really like about it.
It is.
It leaves out in October, November, and the leaves are up all winter,
mm-hmm.
and then in the early spring it goes away
and
it puts up this really phallic-looking seed pod, orange and red and very interesting.
Yeah.
Then that goes away and you forget it's there, and then here it comes again.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious why, and I hope Tony knows, why this plant would have its leaves out all winter and go away all summer.
Mm-hmm.
What's kind of personality? what kind of counseling does this require?
What caused the confusion to begin with,
kind
of thing?
And let me touch on some other, I think, winter interest plants, too, hellebores and things that offer these leafy things when you need them the most.
Mm-hmm. And then joining us, my very favorite entomologist, Tom Turpin.
He's your second favorite Hoosier, I bet.
Yeah, that's right. He is.
right.
My second favorite. Don't worry, you're my first.
Okay.
But he's an entomologist at Purdue University, and he's the author of a bi-monthly column on insects called On Six Legs. And this book, I think, is basically compiled of, you know, some of the best from On Six Legs. It's called Flies in the Face of Fashion, Mites Make Right, and Other Bugdacious Stories. So we're going to talk to Tom about some of the fun stories about insects. I think it's one of those things that makes you appreciate stuff that people sometimes hate, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, it's a book filled of utterly delightful and worthless facts, by and large.
But it makes you appreciate insects.
Oh, no, like the queen termite in Africa can lay 36,000 eggs a day,
mm-hmm.
can live to be 50 to 100 years old. You're talking billions
mm-hmm.
of eggs from mother termite.
Billions of termites.
So to speak. And the fruit fly has 20 generations a year, which explains how they can show up. You can go for 6 months and bring home an apple.
And then you have
fruit flies.
Yeah,
where have they been?
Yeah. Because I've had people ask me that, how did we get flies in the house? Because we keep everything all closed up. And I'm like, they get in, believe me, somehow.
They're waiting.
They are waiting, indeed. So, that's coming up today on Homegrown. So I hope that you'll stay with us, Tony Avent on arum, and then Tom Turpin on delightful insects, bugs, whatever
mm-hmm.
you want to call them. Certainly he'll explain the nomenclature
He's a funny man.
He's a great guy. Bob, what's going on in the garden these days?
I've opened up my fountain. You know, I was waxing whatever I wax late fall. We put in a new fountain out
mm-hmm.
of Hidden Hill and
mm-hmm.
it added waterfalls and added dimension. We buttoned it all up because of the leaf problem in the winter.
Right.
Getting in the water. Well, this past weekend we said the heck with it. We took all the leaves off, opened the pond up again,
mm-hmm.
got it flowing again in this warm weather we had,
mm-hmm.
you know, in late December.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, I got the sound back, but because the leafy cover isn't above it.
It's a different experience.
It's a different sound. I can hear it from the house now.
Yeah.
This little mini roar out in my woods.
That's an excellent point.
Yeah, and I love it. And I was a little leery of doing that, and I think if I ever get down below zero again, I may have a problem keeping
mm-hmm.
it going.
Mm-hmm.
But what a great sound.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it added a whole new dimension to my winter experience I never had before. I can open the garage door, and I cock my head, and how's my fountain doing?
Yeah.
I can hear the water out there.
That's super cool.
Fun. How about the Wishy Estate? What's up?
I am just now starting to selectively clean out the perennial beds a little bit more.
Where have you been?
Well, I didn't want to because things looked so cool. They looked good.
They do, yeah.
And, you know, you see also like all the little seed heads and the birds. I took a walk this morning with the dog before coming down here, and I could not believe how many birds there were everywhere, you know, just in the landscape, in the grass, on the path. I mean, it just goes to show how different birds require different sorts of habitat. Some are ground feeders, some aren't, you know, that sort of thing. But just naturally speaking, this is the longest I've gone without cleaning out, you know, the herbaceous stuff.
Right.
And I think it's made a difference in terms of the bird population.
You
so I'm delighted.
You think the warmer weather brought them back out too?
It probably did, made them a little bit more active.
Yeah.
But I've also noticed when we have really, really cold weather, because I do keep my bird feeders full, they are definitely at the feeder. So I think that having this extra seed out in the garden is kind of keeping them dispersed a little bit. But it's been nice to enjoy, like, I've kept some of it still, like the Joe Pye weed. I'm keeping because it's holding its form.
Right.
It's very architecturally interesting, you know, in the garden, because once you start clearing everything out, it just looks sort of naked. But I've really had fun holding on to that stuff for so long. The, you know, some of my big salvias that I like so much,
yep,
they've held up really well.
Wow.
The butterfly bush,
yep,
you know, things like that, just they provide some good sculptural interest to the garden, but they're also serving a purpose in terms of wildlife.
You are such a good caretaker of the earth.
I'm trying. I really am.
You are, yeah.
I'm making like a totally hardcore concerted effort, yeah, to learn to do the right thing for everybody.
Yeah, I saw some Vitex a week or so ago out in the garden, and it held its form really well. It, mm-hmm, still had the little, of course, the flowers are gone with the,
right,
pods around there and so forth.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed that.
Yeah. Because, yeah, I think, you know, we were at some point like taught that you have to like clean up anything that's,
right,
dead looking.
Yeah.
But if you just think about it in a slightly different way, that which is dead looking is fabulous in the garden for a, yes, great many different reasons.
It's anti-German to do that.
I know it is.
Things go like that.
I'm not following the rules somehow. Oh, my God.
Fraulein Vichy.
Nobody's going to bust me or call me out, except well, that I've already admitted it. So another thing in the garden that I'm enjoying are indeed the arums, because just because there's dead stuff to be cut back this time of the year, there's also a lot of stuff that's still popping up. And that cool veined foliage of the arum,
yeah,
is a great, great ground cover in the winter garden.
Yeah, I became a fan of arum, of course, through Theodore Klein, a name we drop here a lot. But 10 years ago, he gave me some arum. I hadn't seen it before.
Mm-hmm.
And I put it deliberately along the path right next to my door in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
So when I come out the door.
There it is.
There it is.
Good, yeah, idea.
And the man who can tell us all about arum, among other things, is Plant Delight's nursery owner, Tony Avant, now in his 15th year of finding and selling an amazing array of plants, charming, useful, healthy, whimsical, and occasionally totally off the wall. Behind all that is a very serious and opinionated gardener who's helped make us all have more fun in the garden. Tony, welcome to Homegrown.
Well, thank you very much. Good to be here.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about your history and how you got in this business, and then the number of display items you have in your garden, which is kind of astounding when people get to Plant Delight Nurseries.
Well, I think I can blame mine on a strange combination of genes. I think we're all born with certain things that we're able to do, and in my case, plants was it, and that was about it. So didn't have much choice getting into horticulture. So
good thing you're a success, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The plant names I remember with no problem. It's just the people's names that cause the problem. So when you have those quirky skills, you try to figure out what you can do with them and make a living, and horticulture was it.
Okay.
And we do have a fairly extensive garden. A lot of that was based on an article I read as a young child in our local paper that said that perennials don't grow in the South. And I found that fascinating. Later learned that they had bought everything in from Connecticut, and of course it died, really set out to say, let's see how many different plants we can grow and grow well in our region, which is Zone 7. So we began seeking out plants from similar climates all over the world, and currently have just over 17,000 different types of plants growing,
wow,
in our garden.
Mm-hmm.
Not bad.
Not bad.
It's a sickness, but it's a wonderful one.
Well, yeah, it just goes to prove that there's a plant for every type of garden, every type of year. And in this case, we're talking about the arum, which I don't... Can you kind of give us a profile of the arum first? Because I don't think a lot of people are really that familiar with this plant.
Well, arums are wonderful winter interest plants. They're generally from the Mediterranean region. Despite that region growing up in very warm areas, they're extremely cold hardy. Many of them will grow up into certainly zone 5, getting up into Minnesota, certainly way up into the Northeast. They're members of the aroid family, which is the group of family that encompasses things that people know, like peace lilies, spathiphyllum, philodendrons, dumb canes, pothos. Many of the common houseplants are aroids, and so often we just don't realize that they're aroids that are winter hardy. And so the group of arum is it's basically the winter growing version of Jack in the Pulpit.
Okay.
So what's up with the physiology? How can they survive having their leaves out in the winter and then going away all summer?
That's a very good question, and I'm afraid I'm not a physiologist, but they have just adapted to very brutal climates. Over the years, the areas where they're native has certainly changed. An area, a lot of times plants are growing in a warm area that used to be a cold area. So through the years, they've been tossed around climatically, and they've just said, all right, we're going to adapt to pretty much anything you can throw at us. And if you go out in the morning and it's a very cold day, let's say the temperature is at 15 degrees, the leaves will be laying flat on the ground. They'll look like freshly cooked spinach.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And then by 10 o'clock in the morning, they're standing right up again.
Yep.
So they have that ability. It's almost like a rhododendron. If you notice on a cold morning, it's curled up and it looks like it needs a drink of water.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, that's just a defense mechanism that the plant has adapted to over the years to survive these cold temperatures.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. Let's talk about the different types of arum that are available. I have one variety in my garden. I think it's pretty much the garden variety.
Uh-huh.
It has, you know, sort of an arrow-shaped, arrowhead kind of shaped, you know, foliage.
Yeah.
Pretty large. There's a variegation to it, but it's mostly because the veins of the foliage are a lighter color than the dark of the rest of the leaf. Is that the standard one? And then can we step beyond that to highlight some that might look a little bit different?
Well, sure. That is definitely the most common. That would be Arum italicum, the Italian arum. And
mm-hmm.
that's obviously got part of its distribution in Italy. And that's the one that's really everywhere. And if you really start looking, that has a huge native range. And so the interesting things from different parts of the range is it goes from Spain, France, all the way through Italy, across into the Caucasus. So it's a huge native range. And within that, you can find things like solid green leaves. You can find them with almost solid silver leaves.
Hmm.
And then you can find the typical, what we call veined form, which is generally represented in the trade by pretty much a single cultivar called Marmoratum,
mm-hmm.
sometimes mistakenly labeled Pictum.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go to solid green, you can go there. Probably the really prize one is a cultivar called Chameleon, and it was selected years ago for having almost all silver leaves but with a green border.
Hmm.
That's a beautiful thing and still hard to find, but you can often find seedlings from that, and that's what we do a lot of growing is we'll plant two or three of these varieties side by side, and then the little bees do a wonderful job of cross-pollinating, and you come up with just an amazing array of things by crossing the one that you're talking about with something like a Chameleon.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
So that's really what's out there in italicum. Then there are other species that are out there. Probably the next most common is one called Discorides. It's all of them. They have some of them worse odor than others when they flower. Discorides has a wonderful odor of 8-day-old rotten meat.
To attract the flies, I suppose.
Oh, absolutely, to pollinate. And
uh-huh.
But it has one of the most beautiful flowers. It is a deep, velvety, dark maroon highlighted with bright yellow blotches in the flower.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those things, when people see it, you've never seen anything like of it. It's like something from a foreign planet.
Mm-hmm. Does it have the same, does it have the same winter foliage interest and then seed pod in the summer?
It does exactly the same. Those beautiful bright red seed pods that really start forming after the flowers. We typically see flowers here late April, you probably see them in your area early May, and then followed by the seed that lasts for several months in the summer with those short stalks of bright red berries. So, yeah, the seed are very similar on those. And all of the really species except italicum have solid green leaves.
Okay.
There's very little. So if you want the padding on the leaf, you pretty much have to go with italicum.
Mm-hmm.
But if you really get into these cool flowers, oh, just amazing. And then you have things like Arum orientale, the oriental arum, and the flowers on that are jet black.
Wow.
It's one of those plants you have to see to believe.
Mm-hmm.
Now, doing the research, I came across one that is in your catalog, and it listed it as an arum. I'm not sure it is. The corpse flower, the mighty Amorphophallus titanum, is that actually a...
Oh, it's not an arum. It's first cousin twice removed.
Okay.
In the family.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just like the Jack in the Pulpits. It's basically the Amorphophallus or Jack in the Pulpits on steroids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
the Titan arum, as it's often called, titanum. Each flower, which is technically an inflorescence, if you've got any scientist types listening, can get up to 8 feet tall.
Yeah, it's scary.
I mean, it's an unbelievable sight. And those obviously are, that particular one is not hardy, but there are some Amorphophallus that are hardy in your area, and things like Amorphophallus konjac, which has a flower that can easily reach 4 feet tall.
Wow.
That's hardy for you. Amorphophallus cusianus, a beautiful, beautiful flower with a... All aroids have what's called a spathe and spadix flower. Basically, it's like a big hood, and that's called the spathe. And then the, well, the sex organ that comes up in the middle, that's the spadix. And all of these have that. Everything from philodendrons, everything in the whole family has that same type flower. And they're amazing colors. They're just fascinating when they bloom.
But odor can be a problem with those guys, right?
Well, problem is a relative term.
Yeah.
You know, I think it'd be fine to live near a pig farm, but some people have a problem with that.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah, if you have a problem with pig farms, you probably would want to be at work the day you're Amorphophallus flower.
Right. So, Tony, what's the culture of the arum? Do they like full sun, part shade? Can they manage in the clay soil that so many people struggle with today? Are they very picky?
Yeah, arums are really tough. We've grown them in very, very damp soils. In the wild, they grow in very dry soils. In the wild, they grow in, really, a lot of them in full sun. In cultivation, we find it's best if they get maybe half-day sun, half-day shade, all the way to light shade. So they really are not picky. It's one of those plants you almost cannot fail growing arums.
Mm-hmm. I've had... good use of them in an area where they act as a nice ground cover this time of the year, and then as they switch out into their, you know, orange, red, berry phallic things, hostas start to come up, so it's a nice sort of combination of two things.
It really is.
They keep an area full all the time.
Yeah, the great thing about arums is you can basically grow two plants in the very same space.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
For people that are cramped for room, it's absolutely marvelous. You could drop a summer bulb, like a calla, in the very same planting hole.
Mm-hmm.
And when the arum is going down, the calla is coming up.
Can you grow them from seed, those wonderful phallic-looking seed heads in the spring?
They absolutely do. They're very slow. If you plant the seed in the right after they mature in the summertime, they will come up the following year. It'll be about 4 years before you get any size of a plant, so they're not fast, and that's why they're not always the cheapest of plants, because it is a very slow process to get them up. But again, if you plant two unique ones beside each other, they will be out there doing their thing in the middle of the night when no one's looking, and you get some really cool variants in there.
Yeah, you're always working on something. Are you breeding or crossbreeding some arums to see what you can come up with?
We are. We've got a real big program. We were just out from looking at our seedling beds, and a really pretty fascinating stuff. And the potential is there with using other family members.
Mm-hmm.
We also grow a bunch of biarums, and biarums are basically half of an arum.
What's the other half?
It's half size. It's half as big. The leaves are half as wide. And they're a fascinating group of plants. No one's ever heard of them outside the scientific community. But if we could get to be able to cross a biarum with a full arum, and you know, maybe get a three-quarters arum,
right.
Get a little smaller flower, and really cool. These leaves on these can be a quarter inch wide.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
So it's really unique foliage. And so it'd really be neat if we could get the two of those to cross. So certainly something we're working on, and always something new coming down the pike.
Well, you could have a 7/8 arum one of these days if you
could back cross it. Yes. I mean, the potential for all the fractions is there.
15/16.
Sounds great. Well, Tony, we look forward to what you guys come up with out there in North Carolina, and certainly continue out here to enjoy the arum in the winter garden. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tony.
Thanks.
Tony Avan is owner of the Mail Order Plant Delights Nursery in North Carolina. For more information on his nursery or arum, visit our homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, Tom Turpin loves insects, and you will too after you hear some of his bugdacious tales. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And are there any bats in, or not bats in your belfry, bugs in your belfry, Bob?
There have been lately more and more, I think. Uh-huh. They're nesting in there. I don't know what the problem is.
But. Yeah, well, maybe we'll find out a little bit more.
Dr. Turpin,
exactly. A good time of the year, I think, to be thoughtful about all those insects that make up this wonderful world
reflective
that we live in.
About
reflective,
bugs.
Exactly.
Yes, indeed.
There's always room to be reflective about insects. So Tom Turpin is joining us today to talk about the wonderful world of insects. If you have no appreciation for the creeping, the crawling, or the winged, you probably will have a little bit after you hear from Tom. He's going to talk about some of the amazing things that bugs and insects can do. He's an entomologist at Purdue University, where he's been teaching for over 30 years. Some of his classes include Insects, Friend and Foe, Insects in Prose and Poetry, and Beekeeping and Honeybee Biology. Tom's also the founder of the now infamous Bug Bowl, and he writes the bi-monthly column on Six Legs. You can enjoy some of his writings and musings on insects in the recently published Flies in the Face of Fashion, Mites Make Right, and Other Bugdacious Tales. Tom, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be a participant.
Great. Let's iron out first some of the language of entomology, the nomenclature, if you will. What's a bug? What's an insect? You know, what do we need to do or know to speak smartly about this topic?
Well, technically, insects are a group of organisms which are part of a larger group we call the invertebrates, the animals without backbones, and that includes a whole group of things, including things that are called arthropods, like the spiders, some of the creatures that generally have been called bugs, mm-hmm. but...
Anything that you can squish?
Politicians would fall in there, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And you see, the ancient Greeks actually had a word that they called entomos. And they used things like ticks and spiders and snakes and everything fit into that category. Oh. So
and that's where entomology
the word
came
entomology
from.
Literally meant all those sort of slimy, slick, creepy, cry, you know, kind of right. creatures early on. And today we use it just for the insects. But technically the term bug only applies to one group of insects and incorrectly to things like germs and bacteria.
Oh, right. That's right. Yeah. To catch a bug.
Yeah, you catch a bug. And so that's a kind of an improper use of the term because it really was based on that creature called a bed bug, the old... ancient Welsh people had a word boog, which meant spirit of the night, and bed bugs came out and bit at night, and so they were bed boogs.
That's cool. I actually told that story during Halloween, and I learned it from On Six Legs, of course. So who's a bug, then? Are there really not that many bugs, after all?
Well, there are quite a few. Technically, entomologists would tell you that the only insects you can call bugs are members of the order Hemiptera. That includes things like squash bugs and chinch bugs, that old pest that was a problem on corn years and years ago, box elder bugs, any of them that technically have a correct bug in the name are Hemiptera. They're the half-winged insects. If you look at their wing, sort of half leathery and half membranous.
Huh, that's interesting. So evolutionary details of insects and all that entails. Some fly, I mean, would flies be also in that category of insects? Some crawl, some hop, some hover, some have like straight line speed. Are there evolutionary details that kind of demand that you do one or the other?
Oh, I don't think so. Entomologists argue over what was the earliest insects. Most people believe that the very earliest of the things that became insects probably did not have wings. They were very much like the millipedes and the centipedes, which are also invertebrates and arthropods without wings, but they had jointed legs. And at some point, some of those appendages may have been modified, or as some argue, it was a different process to develop wings. But that seems to have been a later development in the insect world. And then some, as they've spent all these years developing, have found that wings are kind of a burden. Mm-hmm. And we have things like fleas and lice that are what we consider to be very early insects, maybe, that evolved to not have wings because they got in their way. So we didn't have them to begin with. We had them
really
in the middle,
well,
and then some of them got rid of them.
Okay.
I'm always intrigued, Tom, by things that are named by what they do, like flies fly. Well, why wasn't the caterpillar called a crawl?
Well, actually, the caterpillar comes from another ancient name, which literally come after the Attic catapulosa, which meant basically a hairy cat.
Oh.
And so that cats will creep along the ground, and to the ancient Greeks, it looked like they were pretty much like that little hairy caterpillar, sort of slinking along the ground, so they named it a hairy cat.
Huh.
Or a catapulosa.
No
catapulosa.
Yeah.
So, Bob, your
I'm
notion
almost,
still holds
I'm almost
true.
Almost wrong here.
Yeah, you're almost wrong.
Well, almost wrong, Bob, is not bad. That's almost right.
Yeah. Believe me, I've been there both ways.
Tom, let's talk about some of the stories that you reveal about insects and other creepy, crawly, delightful things. Let's start with love and courtship before we start with birth, if you will.
Let's hope so.
I guess you could argue that we start with birth, but let's start with love and courtship. What are some interesting ways that insects fall in love and start a family?
Well, I'm not so sure insects fall in love. I think we're giving the benefit of the doubt here. Do they find a mate? They certainly do. And much of their adult life is really designed to find that insect that's right for them. Now, you got to kind of attract a mate. So one of the ways they do it is by producing a perfume, mm-hmm. a pheromone. And so a female moth, who is sort of receptive to love and marriage, if you would, decides she will release that pheromone, and she will wave her wings about, and the pheromone goes floating down the breezes. And some male with a big fuzzy antennae picks that up and says, I hear someone calling my name, and they head upwind. And there she is with that perfume just heading away from her. I mean, I can just visualize, the look in his eye when he picks that up.
So are there any insects that are sort of like peacocks in terms of being very colorful or pretty somehow to attract a mate?
Actually, the color doesn't have a lot to do with mate attraction. It's more perfume and it's more sound in the insect world. For example, some insects sing a lovely tune, the crickets and the katydids. Those are males out there, and they're singing this song to really lure the female over towards them for the purpose of selecting a mate.
Mm-hmm. So that evens things out. I was worried about that.
Yeah.
Well, one thing you got to remember, and I don't want to start a fight down there, but in the insect world, Bob, you'll appreciate this. It is the male that sings. Now, on the other side
but the
of that,
female usually bites the head off.
Yeah, it's the female that bites and stings.
Right.
So, it's the males out there singing a lovely song, and it's the female that's over there grousing around and biting to defend herself and stinging the intruder in her nest.
Yeah, it isn't exactly love. It's more like getting something to eat. But the doodle bug fascinated me in the way it attracts prey. It's almost insidious and unfair.
Oh yeah, the doodlebug is an interesting creature. It's the immature of it's kind of a lacewing type of an insect, and they build these little funnels in a sandy type soil, and then when an insect comes by and it falls down into that little funnel, that doodlebug sticks out a very fearsome looking pair of mouth parts, and it nabs that insect and it sucks the juices right out of it.
Yipe.
So I suppose that attracting insects as your prey, basically, is just as important as attracting them in terms of mating. What are some other stories about insects that are sort of devious in the way that they get their next meal?
Well, certainly we think of the adult insects, the praying mantids that you've already mentioned, actually sit around and mimic the vegetation, the flower, for example, that they sit on. Some of them have a color pattern which is very similar to a flower. And then when an insect lands on a flower, it lands on a praying mantid, and the mantid nabs it and makes a meal out of it. Some insects for example, in terms of a meal, will actually mimic a sound that might be a sound of a insect that would be a mate, for mm-hmm. example. And so they'd mimic that sound and attract another insect down, and they make a meal out of it. Some fireflies will make a light that's the lighting pattern of their particular species, and they'll make the light of another species, and then they'll make a meal out of it. So they use sound, they use color, they use light, all of these to lure a meal down to its death.
Mm-hmm. If you reduce, I guess, human nature, animal nature, insect nature, it's about mating and, you know, perpetuating the species. It's also about survival, which means food, but also, you know, protecting yourself. So what about other survival tactics that are extraordinary? Spines and poison and stinging and mimicry certainly are a part of that. Who's especially good at it?
Well, I think certainly you've mentioned mimicry. I think there are a lot of flies, for example, that look like bees, and flies can't sting, but because they make a sound that's a little bit like a bee and because they look like a bee, then we tend to avoid them. Even some beetles flying around make the sound of a bee, like the green June bug. Mm-hmm. I have people call me and say, I've got these green bees out around my plants in the summer. And, well, those are June bugs. They really can't hurt you, but they're mimicking the bees, and that gives them some protection. One of my favorite of the mimicking insects are those that that actually mimic the bird manure. We call the bird poop moth. And so in the caterpillar stage, they look like a bird dropping, and no bird is going to make a meal out of that. And so that little caterpillar goes merrily on its way, looking very much like bird manure.
Mm-hmm. You remind me of one of the favorites in the fall of the year, the late summer, a caterpillar that is on the fruit trees in the orchard that basically looks like a rust disease or looks like the margin of a leaf that's been kind of burned up.
Exactly. Some caterpillars, and many caterpillars are leaf feeders,
mm-hmm.
and many times they're a green color, so they blend into that environment. But some, like the one you're suggesting, actually is kind of a brownish color, and they hang around the edge of the leaf that they have fed on, which is now beginning to turn brown. And there are actually some praying mantids that do the same thing. Mm-hmm. Some are kind of a brownish color, and they hang around on the leaf litter, and that means that they are protected sort of not only from becoming a meal themselves, but that their prey can't see them, and they'll walk right up to them, and then they become a meal. So it's kind of a two-way street. It protects the mantid from its particular predators, and it allows them to get a meal on their own.
Yeah. So let's go back to the beginning again. Insects and birth. We were talking earlier before the show, most mammals put so much energy into giving birth, you know, mating and giving birth, mm-hmm. that they do it once a year, once a season, usually they have one. But insects are quite different in that they have lots and lots
millions
of babies,
yeah.
And in different ways. And I know that some insects can lay eggs, then they can also maybe overwinter, and then once the generation gets going, they can even give birth to live babies.
Exactly. When we talk about this in nature and in animals, it's really scientifically called what we call K-selected and R-selected species. The K-selected species are like most of the large mammals, for the most part. They give birth to a fairly limited number, and they take pretty good care of them to make sure they survive.
Mm-hmm.
The R-selected species, on the other hand, tend to have many, many eggs or young produced, and they just sort of leave them on their own. Well, you can imagine in the R-selected species, like the insects, many, many of them die before they get to reproduce. In the insect world, we estimate that about 99% die before they get to reproduce. But the 1% will keep them going at about their current level.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, the whole idea within the insect world is lay lots of eggs, give rise to lots of young. You have mentioned that some insects actually give birth to young, and some give birth without having to mate. This is what we call parthenogenesis.
Mm-hmm.
If you got to give birth to lots of individuals, you don't want to spend time trying to find a mate. cut out the middleman, so to speak, Bob, and go on with the whole process.
Boo!
And many aphids do that. I mean, they go to a parthenogenic reproduction in the summer, but they have also discovered that that's not a good way to keep gene pool mixing going on. So in the fall, they go back to the tried and true fashion of finding a mate, mixing up those genes so that you've got a good, vigorous population.
Hmm. Pretty wild and wanton behavior, I'd say.
No kidding. They get what they want when they want it. Are there any insects that are good parents?
Actually, there are a few that are pretty good parents. The earwigs, for example,
oh, of course.
actually attend the egg nest. They sort of protect it. They sort of brood that nest. And even the cockroaches, a few of the cockroaches will carry their egg capsule along with them so that they just don't lay it out there and let the predators have go at it. They carry it along until it's ready to hatch, and then a few of them will even kind of take care of the newly hatched ones for a few days, kind of hover over them and sort of protect them. But as a general rule, insects are not good at parenting. They definitely need to buy some of the good parenting guides because they fail at that end.
Tom, this evolutionary process of these individual insects is just astounding. If we go back 10 or 20 million years ago, any way of knowing if any of the current bugs would exist then, or was it an all-new involving species back then?
Actually, you can go back nearly 350 million years ago and find insects that look very much like those today. Some of the cockroaches, for example, that we find in the Baltic amber and some of the ants, it almost would be impossible to say that those are not very similar to the ants and to the cockroaches that we have today. So it's a pretty good plan that the insects have, and while they've modified it, they've tweaked it, and they've added wings and done some other things along the way, it's a plan that has been a pretty good plan to stand the test of time.
I guess.
Some people are familiar, we don't do it anymore really, or I think some people may be doing it, but the use of leeches in medical treatments for bloodletting and such. But one of the pieces that you had in the book was on using a bug or an insect, I should say, to suture a cut. How useful can insects be in medical treatment?
Well, actually, there are leeches still being used a little bit today. There are some hospitals that use it. More likely, what you'll find in a hospital use today is what's called maggot therapy. And back in the early times of war, when you had a major shrapnel wound or whatever out on the battlefield and you didn't have a way to deal with it, they discovered that if you let maggots of flies actually feed in that wound, that it destroys the sort of the rotting tissue, and then they produce a chemical that causes it to heal. So that was a benefit. And even today, if you have a puncture wound, you can actually have maggot therapy. There are specific medical maggots that could be shipped to the hospital, and they will let them crawl in that wound to deal with it.
I guess if antibiotics stop working, we'll return to maggots.
If we return to the maggots. Sometimes it's best not to tell the patient that what you're doing there,
because
the idea of having maggots crawling around in a puncture wound in the thigh is not what some people would consider to be modern medical practices. But your question about the suturing, some ancient civilizations, and including some that still exist today, if they're out in the wild and they get a cut, they will actually catch some ants. And the ants, once they are held, will actually contract their jaws, and that will form like a stitch suture.
Are these real big ants?
Well, they could be. The bigger they are, the better, because that allows them to have a wider bridge across a particular cut, let's say. So what they'll do is they'll put that ant across that cut with the skin on either side. The jaws will clamp down on it, and they pinch the body off. And so the head of the ant and the jaws are basically sutured to hold that wound in place. This is what we call ant suturing.
So you can have a 50-ant wound.
Have a 50-ant wound. Like, that's what they'll say. Oh, you got hurt in the basketball game. You know, how many stitches did you get?
How many ants did you get?
How many ants did it take to get rid of that spear wound?
That's pretty awesome. Useful tips for survival out there in the backwoods, Bob. I know you were at a national conference recently. Any interesting stories from folks coming out of a national insect conference?
Well, you go to an insect conference and there are a batch of folks talking about bugs. I heard a guy say once upon a time. But one of the things that was interesting, and it isn't entirely new, but I thought it was really fascinating, and historically people have trained dogs to sniff out gypsy moth larvae, for example, mm-hmm. to be able to detect things like fruit coming in on a plane coming from Europe, mm-hmm. or drugs, as you might imagine. Well, we had a fellow at the national meeting that actually trained a dog to sniff out bed bugs. Now, think about this. How neat that is, because today we're getting more bed bug infestations,
right.
and you'll get a transferring of bed bugs from an international passenger who stays in a hotel.
Uh-huh.
The hotel has to establish whether or not there are bed bugs in any of those rooms.
Mm-hmm.
Almost impossible to find. They hide during the day. Mm-hmm. But he's trained this dog who can smell out and detect a single bed bug hiding under, the wallpaper or in the bed. And this little dog, he could go into a room, he'll sniff around in there, and he'll find it if it's there.
Wow.
And so that hotel would now know whether or not they have an infestation in that room. If he can establish they're not there, then they don't have to do chemical treatments,
mm-hmm.
and it would be an advantage to all concerned. So
wow.
I thought this was really neat, and he was a cute little beagle dog, so it was really fun to watch him work.
Man's cool. Best friend.
I think that man may be making more money off that dog than you're going to make off your book, though.
I am reasonably certain of that, and then I got to thinking about it. You know, I know how good dogs' noses are, and to find one is pretty impressive, but bed bugs are stink bugs. They're from that group of insects. And if you get into a room where there are a lot of bed bugs, even I can smell that.
Right.
So you know, that dog is good, but, I wasn't too impressed when
okay.
you think about that. But to find one, I'm going to give him his due.
There we go. Tom, thank you so much.
Thank
it's
you,
always
sir.
Fun to talk to you.
Well, thank you. Uh-huh. Enjoyed it.
Tom Turpin is an entomologist at Purdue University, where he's been teaching for over 30 years. His book, Flies in the Face of Fashion, Mites Make Right, and Other Bugdacious Tales, is published by Purdue University. Of course, if you'd like more information on Tom or his book, please visit our website at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and Miss Wishy's new Latin Word of the Week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
With some December-like questions.
We do have some December-like
questions. That even worked probably in June, but
I really like this question because finally, it fills my heart.
It does.
Because finally somebody is looking at the situation in a smart, practical way. Or I will reinforce that.
Apparently.
It's from Henry. He writes, we have a new old house,
yeah.
which I assume is an older house that's new to them, with very little landscaping. Are there areas to focus on this time of the year, which is December, for planting? We need to spread out the expense, but we do want to do it right. Finally, you know, somebody saying, I know it's going to cost, but I want to do it right, so how do we do it right? Instead of saying, what's the cheapest way I can get this?
Well, Henry, yeah, I'd work on the hardscape, the bigger trees. You can plant trees now. As
you mean
long
the bones, not the hardscape.
That's what I meant,
yeah.
the bones.
Yeah.
As long as the ground is workable, and believe it or not, you can plant trees now and shrubs now, and now's a good time to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to get the bigger things in.
Right, like your
smaller plants are going to heave out, perhaps. You're not going to heave out a 150-pound
well,
tree.
And trees are fine and very actually agreeable to being planted during their dormant time.
Right.
And
so that's what I'd focus on, the shrubs and the trees and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, you may only be able to afford to buy one tree or two trees. Also, keep in mind, the smaller the tree, really, Henry, the better. So many people think that they need to, like, get the big tree. It's not the case at all. Things can establish so much better, and once they establish, they're going to ultimately grow faster for you, right?
Right.
So there's been research done on a 10-foot tree planted here and then a 4-foot tree planted over here, and in a matter of 5 years, the little tree catches up with the big tree.
It's the rabbit and the hare tree.
Mm-hmm, it is. Yep. So don't think you got to go big and, you know, get what you can, what you like. But definitely, as Bob said, get the bones of the garden in first, because those are the things that are going to take a little bit longer. And any kind of woody, dormant, deciduous plant right now, a great time to get it in the ground as long as it's not too wet.
Maybe one of those Christmas trees you're buying and put outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
Quick.
And baby steps the rest of the way, and don't get freaked out, and don't be afraid to get stuff that's small.
Okay. Here's a question from Kathy. Hello, homegrown. Love the show, especially Bob. We just cut back numerous yew trees at our church. Someone said we could stack the yew branches on the non-grassy areas because the needles would decay and fertilize the ground, and the leftover branches could be discarded in the spring. One other church member kind of worried about the branches being a fire hazard. May we keep the branches, or should we discard them? Thanks so much, Kathy.
Well, may we keep the branches, or should we discard them? I can't really tell you what you should do. I mean, you can do either one. I doubt that the little needles falling off of is going to do much fertilization.
No.
You can use them as mulch. We've often cut up our old Christmas trees and put them over the iris beds, Bob,
yep,
to sort of protect, you know, keep them from heaving, yeah, out of the soil. So if you have an area that maybe needs some protection as mulch, you can use them that way. But just sort of throwing them out in an area where there isn't grass.
No. It sounds good, but it isn't really that productive.
Yeah, it may just look kind of weird in the long run, and it could potentially be a fire hazard, honestly, once those needles dry, huh?
That's true.
Yeah. So
if you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org, email us at homegrown@WFPL.org, or call us at 814-8246. Well, Miss Wish, you have heard of the tree amigos, oak, maple, and sassafras.
There you go.
But today's Latin word takes us in
a whole new direction.
Trees.
Yes.
Tree trees.
Latin word of the week this week is ternata, ternatus, ternatum.
Means threes.
It means in threes.
I'm trying to figure out the Latin connection between what I know and... Ternata.
Ternata.
Doesn't always work, does it?
Yeah, uh-uh. With this one, it doesn't make sense in that... Yeah, I don't know. Corydalis ternata.
That would be your three-something corydalis.
Corydalis. There was no common name for that.
Well, corydalis is a neat plant.
Yeah,
people don't know. It blooms real early in the spring.
Yeah.
Kind of got a yellow, whitish bloom to it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes brighter yellow than that. It's a great plant for early spring if you're tired of winter. So
it's like reminds me of like a dainty version of bleeding heart almost.
Yeah.
You know?
And if you plant three of them, it's all the better.
There you go. It's a nice plant. Ranunculus ternatus.
That would be your three-flowered buttercup.
Three-flowered buttercup.
I'm hanging on to the three part strongly here. Yeah.
Oringium ternatum.
The three-clustered?
Oringo.
I don't know. In the way, we oringo.
We love our oringiums, our prickly plants.
Yeah, the three is the main word,
yeah,
here, obviously.
Sedum ternatum.
I got this one. The woodland stone crop.
Three. Again, I mean, like, basically, I think, unless... I mean, it doesn't exclusively have to be, and the next example kind of explain that, but it's typically going to have something to do with the way the flowers present themselves.
Yep.
Epimoa ternifolia.
The old three-leafed morning glory.
Ternifolia, folia leaf,
yep,
right?
Three.
So now we're moved on to leaf.
Three-leaf.
Here's a fabulous one, Bob. Do the math on this one.
All right.
Lomatium.
I love it. I'm ahead of you.
Ternatum.
Three times three.
Nine leaf biscuit root.
That's three times three.
Tri-ternatum.
Yeah. Ternatum is three. Tri is three.
Yeah.
Three times three is nine.
Isn't that fabulous?
I've never seen
Lomatium.
In all the years I've been playing with plants, I've never seen one multiplied. Of course.
I haven't either. Or we just didn't get it, right?
Yeah.
Lomatium tri-ternatum,
nine leaf
biscuit root.
That's a lot of leaves for a little biscuit
root.
That's
pretty cool, though, huh?
Yeah.
We've had biscuit root before.
But not nine leaf.
Not nine leaf, though, exactly. Anyway, so if you see ternata, ternatus, ternatum, ternifolia, or
threes,
some sort of multiplication thereof,
yeah,
you'll know that there's something in multiples of three about that plant.
You think the tree musketeers would qualify for that?
Probably.
Yeah.
Somehow.
They're pretty ternacious.
Indeed. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, ginger in bloom and in bread.
Homegrown is produced by Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.